Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The economic throughline today is budgets, ours, the Greeks, so much debt, so little time. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday today, the 17th of June. Good to have you with us. And if you flip back over the economic news of the past 5 days, there's really only one thing that jumps out at you: Greece and its ever-spiraling debt problems. But the truth is, we just couldn't bear another 90-second news spot on riots and cabinet reshuffle. So we're going to let our weekly wrap take over. Here to do that with us are our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore and Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. They are live in the friendly confines of our New York studio. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
All right, so Lee, riddle me this. First question, and it's kind of the macro thing. Lay out the odds that this Greek thing comes back and gets us here in the United States.
Well, it is back. It's back 1 year later. The odds of it really affecting the U.S. in a major way, I would put at this point still pretty small. I mean, the situation there is pretty serious. Greece is just a fraction of the Eurozone GDP, but it's really, so many countries and European banks hold its debt that the fear here is contagion. You hear that word a lot when you're talking about the European debt crisis. But, you know, the fear is that it could spread and affect European markets, European banks. And given the complexity of the global financial system, we're connected to those banks. But really, at this point, it doesn't really stand to our banks are liquid enough that a liquidity crisis would have to be really severe to affect the banks in the U.S.
All right. So, Heidi, on a scale of 1 to 10, how worried is Wall Street actually about what's going on in Athens and Europe?
In terms of worry, it's probably at 9 or 10. In terms of the potential impact, it's probably quite a bit lower, as Lee said, partially because we can no longer envision a world without bailouts. So it's very difficult to see what the world would look like if an entire country failed. But it does remind us that originally the term too big to fail was not used for banks, but for countries.
Yeah, but Lee, let me ask you this. Somebody said the other day, and I forget where it was in a conversation, they said basically, yeah, Greece is small, but it's a heck of a lot bigger than Lehman Brothers was, and look what happened there.
That's true, but that comparison's a little bit off mark. I mean, when Lehman failed, it froze the entire commercial paper market, which is how companies all over the world finance their short-term day-to-day operations. So, you know, even though Greece is bigger, it is a little more contained. It's a little more, it's regional, and to the degree that it's bigger than regional, it's European. And then you get into the global banking system, but it's not... I don't think that's a fair comparison.
All right. Well, try this one on then, Heidi. Here's another one. There was a period in 2008 where we didn't know what we didn't know, right? We didn't know exposure and banks and limitations and all that stuff. And for all the analysis that's out there, I think people are still a little bit, yeah, well, maybe, kind of, sort of. No?
It's true. Our grasp of banking data is as bad as it ever was. And there are a lot of contracts out there in the market where people have bet on whether Greece will fail or not. And not just Greece, but Italy and Spain. And a lot of those contracts, insurance contracts really, are going to determine how well the banks survive this. If there are a lot of those bets on failure, then the banks might be exposed to a lot of losses or gains depending on where they are. And that's what we have to worry about, because you can't see inside a bank. They move too fast.
Right. Lee, let me get back to Heidi's point earlier about the fear on Wall Street being like a 9 or 10, but actual exposure being a 3 or 4. The markets this week have been up and down and sideways, and every day it's been, oh, the Greek debt is bad, oh, the Greek debt isn't so bad. Well, when's Wall Street going to make up its mind?
Well, Wall Street's very skittish right now. It's not just the Greek crisis, but it's, last week we had some pretty terrible numbers regarding housing. And as housing goes, so does the economy. So everything that we thought was supposed to happen by this time kind of isn't. We also saw consumer confidence fall unexpectedly. The last jobs numbers have not been good. So this on top of that, it really is like we are where we were a year ago. If you remember a year ago, we were recovering, we were cranking, and then all of a sudden May hit and everything fell apart and it was all started with Greece.
Yeah, it feels a little soggy, I got to tell you. All right, Heidi Moore, our New York Bureau Chief, Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. Thanks a lot, you guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Kai.
On Wall Street today, some up, some down, the way it goes. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There was an item in the Wall Street Journal today that wasn't so much a news story as it was a revelation. The paper said the influential lobbying group for seniors, AARP, is, and this is the paper's sentence, dropping its longstanding opposition to cutting Social Security benefits. That sentence was widely welcomed as a sign that the ice might be breaking in the tough debate over entitlement cuts in Washington. Until just a couple hours after the story appeared, AARP did what you might call a partial backpedal. Be that as it may, our senior business correspondent Bob Moon explains there is now some buzz that Washington might finally be ready to talk about the future of Social Security.
As if to soften the glare of a suddenly hot spotlight, AARP issued a statement calling the story inaccurate and declaring in a bold headline, AARP has not changed its position on Social Security. But when we pressed the question, the group's legislative policy chief, David Certner, seemed to leave the door open to debating possible cuts.
We know that benefit cuts will be on the table as part of a package. Our preference is to maintain the Social Security benefits. Others have different opinions and would prefer to cut Social Security much deeper. We need to have that debate, but not just with us, but with the American public.
The distinction the group seemed to draw today was that it doesn't want lawmakers relying on such cuts in the debate over slashing the deficit. Certner insists Social Security is a separate program.
It's financed separately. It should not be cut to deal with a budget deficit it didn't cause.
But some experts pointed out that's a distinction without much meaning. Erskine Bowles co-chaired President Obama's Special Commission on the Deficit. He says separate debate or not, cutting Social Security benefits will result in less red ink. He thinks AARP is trying to gracefully position itself for a seat at the table because it knows that cutting is inevitable.
It's a big move because seniors trust them. And when AARP says that, you know, this is okay, this makes sense, then it makes it easier for politicians to make those difficult choices.
Today, the group seemed to be locked in a delicate dance between political reality and the worries of its members. Bowles suggests it's just the latest group in Washington that's ever so slowly coming to terms with the painful future.
Look, I think you'll see people pull forward, pull back. This is not an easy thing to do, but it is reality. It's what we have to do.
I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
There was a big item in the China Daily when I was there last week about Vietnamese military exercises down in the South China Sea. Perhaps not coincidentally, the Chinese have been running war games offshore themselves the past couple of days. Our China correspondent Rob Schmitz says you can blame all the posturing on hydrocarbons.
Nobody knows for sure how much oil and natural gas lie underneath the bottom of the South China Sea. One estimate puts natural gas reserves there at triple the entire domestic supply of the United States. And that's why China and Vietnam, both rapidly developing and in need of more fossil fuels, are fighting over ownership. Carl Thayer, professor at the University of New South Wales, says Vietnam's banking its entire future on its own piece of the sea.
Its own economists had mapped out that if Vietnam implemented an economic plan that went out to two decades, over half the GDP in Vietnam's trade would come from the maritime area.
Problem is, China's laying claim to the same maritime area. In the past year, China's also scuffled with Japan over another island chain. University of Wisconsin political scientist Edward Friedman says all this posturing is Beijing's effort to show the U.S. it has a powerful navy, too. He says after the global financial crisis, China came to the conclusion the U.S. wasn't recovering quickly. China was.
And that this was a unique moment, finally, for China to get justice.
But Peking University professor Zhu Feng says in this latest conflict, China is just responding to an aggressive push by both Vietnam and the Philippines to explore for oil.
Beijing hasn't just moved down to the disputed area for any oil exploration. So I have to say it's Vietnam and the Philippines change the status quo.
Here's another shift in the status quo. China's building 30 sea vessels in the next 5 years to patrol what it claims is its maritime territory. Unless the U.S. becomes involved, Professor Thayer says, neither Vietnam nor the Philippines are strong enough to resist that. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Somewhere between number 1 and number 18, you find time to bring up what you need to bring up, and it works.
The golfing life, Washington style. But first, let's do the numbers. Kind of a mixed bag on Wall Street today after France and Germany outlined a way to help debt burden Greece. The Dow Industrials gained 42 points this Friday. about a third of 1%, 12,004 the number. The NASDAQ trimmed off 7 points, about a quarter percent, finished at 2616. The S&P 500 picked up 3 points, 0.3%, closed at 1271. For the week, the Dow and the S&P each gained 0.4%, the first time they've won for the week in 6 weeks. The NASDAQ lopped off about 1%. Research in Motion's disappointing results late yesterday cost the BlackBerry maker today. Its shares plunged 21% and pulled down some related technology stocks. Marvell Technology Group, which makes electronics for mobile phones, lost more than 4%. Apple bit off 1.5%. Cisco Systems gave up about 0.5%. Amazon gained 1.5% today. The online retailer showed strong in year-over-year sales for May. eBay also increased sales and fattened up 1.25%. The 10-year T-note fell. The yield rose to 2.95%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up June 20th. Did you procrastinate on your spring cleaning? Monday is your deadline, the last day of spring. If you're in Paris, you'll be looking up. The Paris Air Show opens. And where are all the country's mayors? Watching John Waters. He's performing in Baltimore at the annual meeting of the United States Conference of Mayors. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Okay, so this is a cold and heartless thing to say, but it's true. There is almost nothing Wall Street can't turn into a profit-making opportunity. I'm talking specifically here about claims against Bernie Madoff. There's a multi-billion dollar market out there of investors buying up those claims from the victims of Madoff's Ponzi scheme, all in the hopes of winning a payoff later. Michael Rothfeld had the story in the Wall Street Journal today. Michael, good to have you with us.
My pleasure.
Tell me about these claims markets. How do they work?
Well, typically in any kind of a bankruptcy, when there are people who are owed money, they're entitled to collect money that they lost. And that could happen in a corporate bankruptcy or in the case of Bernard Madoff's Ponzi scheme. These are victims who invested with him and lost money. And basically it could take years for any of that money to come back, and it's fairly uncertain. So what happens is there are distressed debt experts, investors who are offering them upfront cash payments, and they're hoping that down the road they'll be able to collect more money. So the creditor gets some money up front, and then the investor is hoping to make a profit.
Yeah, you say some money up front. So how much are these actual claim holders getting? Are they getting 30 cents on the dollar, 70 cents on the dollar?
Right now they're selling between 70 and 75 cents on the dollar. And when this first started around a year ago, they were getting 20, 25 cents on the dollar. And the price jumped up dramatically after in December there was a huge settlement for $7 billion by a former Madoff investor named Jeffrey Pickauer. And so that brought the pot of available money up. And so it showed people that the recoveries were going to be significantly higher than they thought before.
Yeah, that is to say the people who are buying these claims have a much better chance now of actually being in the money when the payments are made, right?
That's right. If you're an investor right now, you know based on what has already been recovered, you're going to get at least 50 cents back on the dollar from your losses. So if somebody wants to buy your claim, you're not going to sell it for less than 50 cents and you're not going to sell it for 50 cents. You're going to sell it for more. And the investors obviously are hoping that eventually, and they have to have some reason for thinking this, that they'll get maybe 85 cents on the dollar so that they can make a nice profit.
Yeah. These claims markets, the secondary markets, basically have been around for a while, but it is just another example and a very specific example with the Madoff case of Wall Street being able to buy and sell pretty much anything, right?
That's right. And in the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy, which is going on also right now, this is a big thing that's happening. And the same thing as in Madoff, where there's people who are being sued or banks that are being sued to get money back into the bankruptcy. And at the same time, on the back end, they're also trying to profit off of this by trading in claims.
Yeah. Say that again. Some of the banks who are being sued over the Madoff incident are trying to buy up some of these claims, right? So they're working both ends against the middle.
That's right, at least a couple of the banks. And so what happened was that as Madoff was operating, there were a lot of banks that worked with investment funds, hedge funds, that fed money to Madoff. These were known as feeder funds. And so now they're being sued by the trustee who's trying to recover money that went out of Madoff when these feeder funds withdrew money. And so they're being sued on that end. And then on the other hand, a couple of them, UBS and Royal Bank of Scotland are two of them, they are also trying to trade in these claims or have at least made some bids on some big Madoff claims.
Completely legally, we should point out.
There's nothing illegal about it.
Michael Rothfeld writing in the Wall Street Journal today about the secondary market in claims against Bernie Madoff. Michael, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
Time now for today's lesson in how the politics of the American economy actually work. Yesterday, the Senate voted overwhelmingly to end a federal tax break for ethanol, the stuff made from corn that gets blended into gasoline. If it gets by the House and signed by President Obama, gasoline refiners are going to start paying the United States Treasury an extra $6 billion a year. The turnaround on ethanol subsidies is a big fall from grace for a domestically grown fuel that's supposed to help reduce our reliance on foreign oil and also happens to be politically well-connected. And the vote could eventually mean a breakthrough on cutting the deficit, as Marketplace's John Dimsdale explains.
Tax subsidies for corn ethanol used to be as American as apple pie for most politicians, especially for those with an eye on the White House.
You know, they wouldn't be there if it wasn't for an Iowa caucus.
Charles Cook is editor of the Cook Political Report. He says the country's earliest presidential primary caucus is in the heart of corn country.
It was sort of a silver bullet type way to get ahead. Now, that's changed some because the budget politics have changed the way the world's working.
That's somewhat of an understatement. More than two-thirds of the Senate voted yesterday to immediately end the 45-cent per gallon tax credit for oil refiners who blend ethanol into gasoline.
Which means raising a tax.
Vin Weber is a former GOP congressman. He says the fact that almost three-fourths of the Republicans in the Senate would vote against ethanol subsidies creates an opening for the idea that tax hikes are one way to balance the books.
If there is some way of defining increased revenues that are acceptable to conservatives as not violating their creed of opposition to tax increases, that's a big deal.
Because it creates more revenue-raising opportunities. As examples, Weber points to recommendations from several deficit reduction commissions to trim or eliminate tax breaks for real estate investments, corporate research and development spending, or export incentives. Call it closing loopholes or cutting tax expenditures, says Weber. Just don't call it raising taxes. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Kraft Foods now has an even dozen brands that are worth $1 billion, joining the likes of Oscar Mayer, Maxwell House, and Oreo, is an orange powdered drink most of us probably haven't even thought of since we were kids. So, who's buying Tang now? Sally Herships has the story.
Remember Tang? Of course you do.
The astronauts do some things you do. In space, they drank Tang. They mixed it like this in a zero-G pouch.
When the drink came out in the late 50s, it was orange-flavored. But now it comes in exotic flavors like tamarind and lemon pepper. Maybe that's why Tang sales have almost doubled over the past 4 years.
New products, new flavors, new package forms, new sizes.
Gary Steibel is CEO of New England Consulting Group. You can now buy Tang in Egypt and Indonesia and Turkey. But Steibel says, despite press reports, we don't have a true global economy.
The economy in the Philippines is very different than the economy in Brazil.
Which means companies often market the same product differently in different countries. Rob Solomon teaches international strategy at NYU.
Tang in the United States is a fairly mass market kind of brand, but in other countries it's positioned as almost a dietary supplement.
Yes, Tang is for kids, but it's a nutritious drink that provides vitamins and minerals. Kraft pumps up the health angle for moms shopping in other countries. Last year, Kraft bought Cadbury, which gave Kraft more access to markets around the globe.
They can just take their existing products, like Tang, and push them onto Cadbury's customers.
In case you're wondering, the best-selling Tang flavor is still orange. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
This is a big weekend for golfers, especially those within driving distance of the Washington Beltway. The U.S. Open is at the Congressional Country Club in Bethesda, Maryland. But for those who like a little politics with their 18 holes, President Obama and House Speaker John Boehner will tee off together on Saturday. Golf has played a big part in the business of Washington for decades, but interestingly enough, politics are changing that. Marketplace's David Gura has more.
You might not know this, but there's a Congressional Golf Task Force.
On both sides, you know, there's quite a few golfers, both Republican and Democrats, that love the game.
That's its chairman, Joe Baca, a Democrat from California. He keeps a handwritten roster of every golfer in the House and Senate.
Tim Ryan, Mike Doyle, Cedric Richmond, Ed Perlmutter.
Baca calls himself an avid golfer. He plays on weekends and he practices his swing in a gym on Capitol Hill. And Baca says the game makes him a more effective congressman.
You're able to build a relationship, and building the relationship with someone becomes very important and critical on the legislation, because then people say, well, you're not such a bad guy, you know.
Golf is also an easy way to raise money.
People sometimes get tired of going to a banquet, you know, and they say, oh, another rubber chicken.
Those supporters jump at the chance to play golf with politicians at tournaments that take place in Washington and at clubs across the country.
Bill Clinton played with contributors who gave $50,000 for the privilege of playing a round with the President of the United States.
Don Van Natta Jr. wrote a book about presidents and golf called First Off the Tee. There are restrictions now on donations to campaigns and political action committees, or PACs, but it can still cost several thousand dollars to play in a tournament. Lobbying rules have also changed since Clinton was president. Congressman John Yarmuth remembers what it used to be like.
Under the old rules, the lobbyists could take you out. I worked on the Hill in the early 70s, and it was routine for a lobbyist to invite even a staffer out at that point and play, and that doesn't happen anymore.
That's made Fred Eames' job harder. He's an energy lobbyist who's played golf at tournaments alongside Speaker Boehner.
You almost can't buy somebody a cup of coffee anymore.
Never mind a round of golf, which can cost hundreds of dollars. Eames laments what happened to what he calls the social aspect of politics.
People have tried to weed that out of politics, thinking that there's something nefarious behind it. And frankly, I think it's essential to the kind of compromise that a lot of people would like to see in politics.
He says golf is a way to make contacts and to forge friendships.
And building those sorts of relationships are valuable for the business that comes later.
I asked Peter Finch if it's impolite to talk shop while you play. He's an editor at Golf Digest. The magazine just ranked the most prominent golfers in Washington by handicap, and Eames, Yarmuth, and Baca are near the top.
You don't usually do it on the first tee, and you probably don't do it on the 18th green, but somewhere between number one and number 18, you find time to bring up what you need to bring up, and it works.
Spokesmen for the White House and the speakers say we shouldn't expect a deal tomorrow, but some are holding out hope that somewhere on the back nine, the conversation might turn from drivers and divots to the debt. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note to close out the week, a chance to take a break, ignore the big news of the past 5 days, and catch up on the fun stuff. It comes to us, as it always does, courtesy of Brendan Francis Noonan, Rico Galliano, and the rest of the Marketplace staff.
Stacey Vanek-Smith, senior reporter for Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, it's actually kind of cool. They are creating a huge campground here in New York City, kind of near JFK.
Oh, just like we have here in L.A., except we call it Skid Row.
Kind of. There'll be eventually 600 sites. Uh-huh. They'll have a campfire and a picnic table. And, yeah, people can camp in the middle of New York City.
Well, I imagine in that insane rent market, this actually may be a viable option for a place for people to live.
That's true. Soon you won't be able to get a space without an agent.
Studio apartment in Brooklyn. Rustic.
Great natural light and a lot of charm.
Mitchell Hartman, entrepreneurship reporter up in Portland. What are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Urination, believe it or not.
That sounds like great dinner party fodder.
A guy goes up to the reservoir in Portland where the city draws its drinking water, and he peed into it. It was caught on videotape, so they are draining the entire reservoir. 8 million gallons of water. They're pouring it down the sewer.
Is that really necessary?
They say it's health-wise not, but there's this gross factor. Nobody's going to want to drink the water. So they're pouring it out.
A very quick question. When they drained the reservoir, did they find like a giant puck-shaped freshener at the bottom?
I certainly hope not.
Deb Clark, senior producer for Marketplace Money. What's your story this weekend?
Elk clips.
Go ahead.
I was just in China, where apparently there's a huge appetite for all kinds of animal bits. So a bunch of elk clips were part of a seizure on the Russian border. There were 26 of them in this huge pile of exotic animal parts. They weighed by themselves 143 pounds.
Ah, the famous Jagger elk.
Yeah, I am so not sorry I missed that story, I gotta tell you. There is more where that came from. It's all on a podcast that Rico and Brendan do called The Dinner Party Download. There is a link, of course, on our website. It's marketplace.org. And that's it on a Friday. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 42 points, about a third of 1%. The NASDAQ trimmed off 7 points, about a quarter percent. The S&P 500 picked up 3 points, 3 tenths of 1%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Weston. The executive producer of the program is a guy by the name of J.J. Ewer. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, 2 defaults in 3 years and ready to try again.
Now we're in the clear. I can't declare bankruptcy for 7 years, so financially I'm a really low risk. But the banks will not lend me money.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend. We will see you back here on Monday. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.